This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. After drawing on his life in his satirical novels, like the Russian debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, and Super Sad True Love Story, our first guest, Gary Steingart, has written a memoir called Little Failure. Steingart spoke with Terry last Tuesday. As Andy Borowitz wrote in his New York Times review, Little Failure is both hilarious and moving. Steingart was a wheezing, asthmatic, and fearful 7-year-old when he and his parents emigrated from the Soviet Union to Queens, New York in 1979. This was soon after America negotiated a trade deal with the Soviets that included allowing Jews to emigrate to Israel, Canada, or the U.S. Suddenly, little Gary was living in the country he'd been taught was the enemy. His parents, who'd been prevented from practicing Judaism in the Soviet Union, sent Gary to a Hebrew school in Queens where he felt lost and despised. As he slowly became more American, the distance between him and his parents seemed to grow. As he got older, girls, booze, and eventually 12 years of 4-times-a-week psychoanalysis entered the picture. Throughout, writing was a constant, dating back to when he was 5 and wrote a comic novel that was 100 pages long.
Gary Steingart, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You know, part of your book is about when you were growing up, you had such severe asthma. That was part of the reason your family left Russia. And I'd like to start by having you read a paragraph from the beginning of your memoir. And it has to do with one of the reasons why your family left.
Yes. And by the way, anyone who wants to be a writer out there, the first thing you have to have growing up is asthma. So I recommend growing up in a place like Leningrad, which was built over a swamp, which will be very conducive to your not breathing. So here is what happened and one of the main reasons we did leave Russia. Unbeknownst to me, my mother was in the middle of a crisis herself, wondering whether to stay behind with my sick grandmother in Russia or leave her behind forever and emigrate to America. The decision was made for her in a greasy Crimean cafeteria. Over a bowl of tomato soup, a stout Siberian woman told my mother of the senseless beating her 18-year-old son had endured after his conscription by the Red Army, a beating that had cost him a kidney. The woman took out a photo of her boy. He resembled a moose of great stature crossbred with an equally colossal ox. My mother took one look at the fallen giant and then at her tiny, wheezing son, and soon enough, we were on a plane bound for Queens.
Did you grow up with a sense of guilt or responsibility for having uprooted your parents?
In a sense. I mean, we realized when we got to America that, good Lord, leaving the Soviet Union was going to be great for everyone involved. I mean, it was a disaster. I remember seeing my first Chevrolet Corvette thinking, this is science fiction. Things like this aren't supposed to exist. You know, in Russia, we had these sort of nerdy science fiction films where a man in a space helmet walked around the soundstage and, you know, there were little twinkling stars behind him. But this was the 21st century right there. I fell in love with it so ridiculously and immediately that there really wasn't in my we realized that this was where we belonged. And the Soviet Union was also falling apart at that point. It was the beginning of the end, the Brezhnev years, 1979, which I guess is funny because, you know, once I settled in America, this country also began to unravel. So I am the destroyer of superpowers. Everywhere I go, things fall apart. They won't even let me land in China anymore because they're so afraid of destroying there.
Were your parents as taken with America as you were?
I think even more so. I mean, I think my father loved the idea that he was the one that really believed in Judaism to a large extent. And he wanted me to join. He joined the synagogue immediately. And that was the one community that he felt really close to were these Orthodox Jews. I, on the other hand, was sentenced to 8 years of Hebrew school for a crime I did not commit. but it was, you know, and it was not. It was a conservative school in Queens. And to him, being Jewish was this amazing thing that he had fought for all his life, and he was denied in Leningrad. But for me, it was a different experience. Those were the years when, you know, being a Russian was how you were labeled. You were labeled a Russian. It wasn't this just Confederacy of Jews. It was American Jews and Israeli Jews, and then there was me and a couple of other Ruskies, and we were despised pretty roundly. You know, all those movies, Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster, And also, I had this fur coat and a fur hat, and it smelled of woodland animal-type smells. And the teachers would take me aside and say, look, you can't be this furry. You can't dress in all these furs. children won't play with you if you have that much fur on. And basically what I was told every day in school, that where we came from was wrong and where we were now was right. I'm not even going to dispute that, but it's a lot for a seven-year-old, for a sensitive seven-year-old boy to be told that everything he loved and believed in has to be replaced with something else.
Do you actually believed in Lenin? You wanted to join the Red Army?
Yes. I mean, I would have been killed in the Red Army within the first day of hazing. But when I was a kid, there was a huge statue of Lenin outside our apartment. And every morning, if I was allowed to leave the house, if my asthma wasn't bad enough, I would hug the pedestal of Lenin. And he just felt like a relative. He felt like just another bald, goateed relative that I had. And I wrote a little book called Lenin and His Magical Goose. I wrote it for my grandma, in which Lenin meets a magical goose and they invade Finland and create a socialist revolution. But the goose turns out to be Menshevik and Lenin is Bolshevik. So Lenin eats the goose for political reasons. But then at the end of the book, we find out that Lenin also suffers from asthma.
You were a child when you
were 5 years old.
I guess it's not clear. Yeah.
Yes, I was 5 years old, and my grandmother paid me in little slices of cheese for each page. So it was 100 slices of cheese for 100 pages. Even today, Random House pays me in cheese. So the tradition continues.
In Russia, your family was discriminated against for being Jewish, even though they weren't practicing. Then you come to the United States, and you're sent to a Hebrew school instead of a public school. And so suddenly, you're put in the middle of a pretty religious environment. What sense did religion make to you at that point? And what was your understanding of Judaism, of God? That's a really big question, isn't it?
Yes.
You're welcome.
Well,
yeah.
You know, thank you. My problem was I didn't know any English, you know. So on top of not knowing English, there was another language, Hebrew, which is even harder, that they were trying to teach me. And it was too much. It was too much overload. And at home, we had no television, so I couldn't learn English from TV. So for the first years in Hebrew school, I would sit apart from everyone at the cafeteria as they ate, and I would just have long conversations in Russian with myself. So here was this fruitcake wearing this gigantic fur hat and fur coat, speaking in a language nobody understood. And all the kids would run up to me and do the sort of, you know, the crazy sign and laugh. But I wouldn't stop because that was the only language that would make me comfortable. And my mother wasn't there, but in speaking it, I could pretend that the people I loved were around me. And I could pretend I would talk about all the things I'd seen before we left Russia, you know, the beauties of Yalta and all the different, we did a tour of all the places where Chekhov used to hang out. And you know, again, things that are not going to endear you to a bunch of first grade, second grade kids, especially if you're not speaking it in their language. And the prayers, the endless prayers, Baruch Atah Adonai, over and over and over again. I mean, I realized that God was bigger than all of us. There was my father who was big, and there was God who was probably even bigger. And that was the rankings in terms of parental figures. And I remember reading we were taught very early on Abraham sacrificing Isaac. And I really thought, okay, I could sort of see my father in this role. He sent me to Hebrew school. He's gonna cut my throat because God says he should. And then God says, God is always the nice guy, and God says, hey, just kidding, you know, put that knife down, you crazy guy, Abraham. So that also reinforced this feeling that I had that life was very mercurial, that anything could happen, that there was absolutely, I was at the mercy of people higher than myself, which is, I guess, what a child can feel. But there wasn't a great feeling of safety. You know, I was in a school where I couldn't speak the language, where I walked around with my shoelaces untied, where the kids despised me, where, you know, it was a Hebrew school. But Russians were hated so much at that point that I started convincing everyone that I hadn't been born in Leningrad. I was born in East Berlin. So I was trying to convince Jewish kids that I was actually a German. To be better liked and not, you know, beaten as much. I was trying to turn myself into a Nazi rather than a commie.
So at some point you wrote perhaps your first work of satire. You wrote a satirical version of the Torah that you called the Gnorah. Because why was the title that?
Well, because the kids started calling me. There was a television show that I couldn't watch because we didn't have a TV show, but it was called...
You mean you didn't have a TV, yeah.
We didn't have a TV, but it was called The Great Space Coaster. People of my generation may remember it. It was a show that featured a cartoon, not a cartoon, a puppet antelope called Gary Gnu. And his shtick was, no gnus is good gnus, with Gary Gnus there's no gnus guaranteed, or something like that. And he wore a turtleneck, and he was this pretentious newscaster, and I didn't know who he was because I couldn't watch him so much, but I started to appropriate his lingo. And then, so the Torah, because it was now the story of the Gnus instead of the Jews, it became the Genora, and, you know, Exodus became Sexodus, and, you know, I was about 11 or 12, so it was already getting pretty raunchy there. There was some,
I want you to read, you reprint a little of it in your memoir, Little Failure. I want you to read a short excerpt of your Genora.
Sure. And God spoke. Don't worry about ethics. This does not, however, mean you can act like John McEnroe. Do not pray to statues of Michael Jackson or Tom Selleck. I am your God. If you see a blind man, do not cheat him. For example, do not sell him cocaine when it is really angel dust. Don't swear in the name of Brooke Shields. By doing so, you are insulting my name. Oh, we all love Brooke Shields. Oh, my God. There was a centerfold of Brooke Shields in People magazine that the boys of Hebrew school passed around until it was more shredded than the Talmud by the time we were over through with it.
Okay. So in this Genora that you wrote actually was a real turning point for you, because it established you as a kind of a satirist in your school. People, it got passed around. It was popular. And also, it was the first time you felt really comfortable using the English language and being able to do things, to make it really work for you.
Right. It was this, you know, here I was for years trying to make sense of this hostile environment, and all of a sudden it kind of clicked, and I thought, oh, I mean, maybe I didn't put it in these terms, but what do Jews like, you know, other than not eating pork and praying quite a bit and wearing the tefillin and getting circumcised all the time? What do Jews like? And I thought, humor. This is our main thing. This is what we do better than, you know, than anyone. And satire especially. And so here we were at Hebrew school getting bombarded with Talmud and Torah and saying things that made really very little sense, reading aloud. It was all about rote memorization. And I thought, let's have some fun with this. Let me really get to the bottom of what this sounds like to us, you know. And I did. I had a very tenuous connection to popular culture, but I knew some things. I knew that John McEnroe was acting out. I knew that Brooke Shields was the most beautiful woman that ever lived. And in fact, I think we were a lot of debates about whether she was Jewish or not, you know, whether she was Brooke Shieldowitz. That was sort of our big dream, was that she could be part of our tribe. If she was a part of our tribe, then we really wouldn't win. We wouldn't need all those Nobel Prize winners. We could just have Brooke Shields. So all those different things. And then also making fun of some of the kids in school that weren't so nice to me. And, you know, it was written on an actual scroll, which I typed sideways so that it looked like a real Torah. And I put the two, I can't remember what they're called, the two sort of sticks that hold the Torah with which you can unroll the scroll. So it was a really professional job. And I would pass it around. And kids who never, you know, what happened was that the kids who just thought, oh, here's that Russian kid, all of a sudden I wasn't just that Russian kid. I was, you know, that crazy kid who wrote the Genora.
Because you couldn't practice, your parents couldn't practice Judaism in the Soviet Union when they lived there. When you got to the United States, your family wanted you to be circumcised and brought into the, you know, the Jewish tribe. How old were you when you were circumcised?
I think it was around 8 or 9, maybe 8. I'm a little fuzzy on the details since I've been trying to repress them for so long.
But yeah. but you uncorked those memories for your memoir, and it's both a really painful but also a really funny chapter. I want you to read just a little bit of that. And I should mention, because this will be referred to in the reading, there's a reference to Emmanuel, which was a series of softcore porn movies that your father mistakenly took you to.
It was called Emmanuel, the Love of a Woman, I believe, or Emmanuel, the Wants of a Woman. And it was, I don't know if it was softcore, I think it was medium core.
Okay.
Porn. And my father was a big aficionado of French culture, and he thought this would be a wonderful way to get his son involved with, you know, Balzac and Voltaire. And so... You know, and then we went in there, and there was a theater on Main Street in Flushing, and It was one vagina after another. And he just put his hand around my eyes, and I kept trying to pry his hand off because I desperately wanted to see what was on the screen. And I did see, I counted about 7 genitals that I saw, which was 7 more than I would see for a very long time.
So, because there's a reference to that, now everyone will know what you're referring to. So if you could read like a brief section of your chapter about being circumcised at the age of, did you say you were 8?
I think 8. I could be wrong on that. I'll have to ask my mohel, my circumciser. Okay. The next year, I get the present every boy wants, a circumcision. At Solomon Schechter School of Queens, I have been given an appropriately sacrificial Hebrew name, Yitzchak, or Isaac. And so the knife is drawn at Coney Island Hospital, Orthodox men davening out a blessing in the adjoining room, a sedation mask placed over my mouth, perfect for an asthmatic boy with an anxiety disorder. And then the public hospital walls, green on green on green on green, disappear to be replaced by a dream where the horrible things lovingly perpetrated upon Emmanuel in a Hong Kong brothel are done to me by the men in black hats. And then the pain. Mama, Papa, where are you? And then the layers of pain. Mama, Papa, help! And then the layers of pain and humiliation.
Okay, and it goes on in the book. That sounds like a really horrible chapter of your life that lasted, the pain and humiliation lasted a lot longer than you would have liked.
Yes. Try this at home.
Yeah. In retrospect, do you think your parents did the right thing in having you circumcised at the age of 8-ish?
My father's belief was that without this, I would not be fully a Jewish boy. And in his mind, there was nothing more important than making sure that I was a Jewish boy. I think my mother probably had her doubts. I'm pretty sure she did because she's very against these kind of medical interventions. But I think for him, it meant the world to him. It was awful for me, but some kind of bond did survive, you know. I did become what he always wanted to be, which was a person growing up in a country where being Jewish wasn't a mark against you. In some parts of New York, it was a mark for you, you know. And I'm not super happy that it happened, but I've certainly made peace with my mohel.
You quote the writer Cheshalom Milosh as saying, when a writer is born into a family, the family is finished. And your parents were very worried about this memoir because so much of it is about them, so much of it is about the tension in your relationship with them. I don't blame them for being worried. I mean, they didn't ask to have their lives exposed in the way you're exposing it. What makes you willing to do that as a writer?
It's scary. It is scary because I love them so very, very much. The last thing I would ever want to do is hurt them. What I wanted to make sure was that the reader didn't come away thinking, okay, this is a mommy dearest hatchet job, because it's not at all. It's I try to nuance what happened. I try to really draw out the complexities of people who meant well, who continue to mean well, but in so many ways were sabotaged by their history, by the way they were raised, by the difficulties of immigration, by the difficulties of assimilation, by the fears that haunted them from the, you know, killing fields of Belarus during World War II to the Stalinist labor camps in Siberia. I mean, just I wanted to give the reader as full a portrait as I can of them to try to explain who they are and then to try to explain as best I can who I am.
Do you feel like they learned more about who you are from reading the book?
Oh, they haven't read the book yet. I just sent them a copy. So,
I've read it and they haven't?
Yes, exactly.
You didn't send them the galleys or the page proofs?
I didn't send them the galleys. I wanted them to get the finished product. So I sent it to them when I got copies of the book, the finished book. Because I also wanted this to be as accurate as I remembered it. You know, and there were some changes, I think, between the galleys and the final product. And this book involved terrible amounts of research. I mean, I would interview kids I went to high school with and Hebrew school with and hours and hours sitting down with my parents. A lot of the dialogue is basically just stuff that I videotaped them walking around St. Petersburg or sitting at my dining table in Manhattan and just interviewing them there. I wanted this, you know, it's important for me. This is sort of the important thing is, I want there to be a record of what it was like for this bizarre generation that was born in one superpower and emigrated to another. I mean, this is a very 20th century story. I mean, I want this to be almost a matter of a kind of historical record. I mean, that makes it sound very boring, and hopefully there's a lot of humor in this book that keeps the reader turning the pages. But I want people to know what it was like. Two countries competing for the world, you know, the capitalist system of America and the turbo-capitalist system of America and the languishing quasi-socialist system of the Soviet Union were going head-to-head. And you were born in one country and then you moved to the next. And you grew up in lies. You moved to a place where the lies were different. You know, they were less obscene, as in Soviet lies where, you know, the grain harvest was always going up and everyone in the world loved us. But, you know, there's a scene where we land in America and we get an envelope from the publisher's clearinghouse. And it says, "Dear Mr. S. Gart," they didn't quite get our name right, "you have already won $10 million. And we opened it up and there was a check for $10 million. And we thought, oh, my God. Мы миллионеры, we are millionaires. I remember screaming to my father, "Мы миллионеры, we are millionaires now." And I remember thinking, now my life, our lives will change. Nobody's going to make fun of me or hit me in Hebrew school because I'm going to have money now. And hell, maybe I won't even go to Hebrew school after having $10 million. And maybe we'll move to Florida. And I mean, all these fantasies. I was just, it was the happiest night of my life. I couldn't go to sleep. I was just so excited. Maybe a girl will kiss me now that I have $10 million. And but then we were talking about, oh, but those welfare queens will steal $5 million. That's what Ronald Reagan said. So we'll only have $5 million. Okay, fine. We'll have $5 million. And on and on and on it went. And we were just so full of just joy at winning it. And then, of course, the next day at work, they told my parents, look, you know, everybody gets these envelopes and you didn't win $10 million. And we were hurt for a while. But then, like all immigrants, we just got back to work and worked even harder and harder to make sure that we could buy that first garden apartment, which would then turn into a nice house and then, you know, pay for my Oberlin education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So as outlandish as my story is in some ways, it is, I think, there is a universality to it that will remind a lot of people, I think, of their childhoods in America.
Well, Gary Steingart, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Gary Steingart speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Steingart's new memoir is called Little Failure. You can read the first chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our TV critic, David Bean Cooley, says two new miniseries this week are worth special mention and couldn't be more different. One, The Spoils of Babylon, is a miniseries soap opera spoof on IFC. The other, True Detective, is a new drama from HBO, which David says starts out as the best HBO drama since The Wire.
True Detective, which begins Sunday on HBO, is a combination series and miniseries, kind of like American Horror Story on FX. Each season is designed to tell a different self-contained story, followed the next year by a new tale with new characters and sometimes even new actors. This first season of True Detective is an 8-hour murder mystery starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, neither of whom is expected to return next season. But catch them while you can, because this first salvo of True Detective is riveting. My, what a narrative, and what performances. Just after saying goodbye to Tremé, HBO presents another complicated drama series set in Louisiana. Novelist Nick Pizzolatto has written all 8 episodes, and Cary Fukunaga has directed them all, so there's a strong unity of vision. The closest things I've seen to True Detective on TV are Homicide, Life on the Street, and The Wire, which I intend as the highest kind of praise. Woody Harrelson plays Martin Hart, a respected detective who was born and raised in Louisiana. Matthew McConaughey plays Rust Cole, a former undercover cop from Texas with a tragic past and an even more tragic worldview. Within weeks of being assigned to each other as partners, Hart and Cole catch a gruesome ritualistic murder. A young woman found dead in the woods, tied to a tree, posed unnaturally, draped with a crown made of antlers. True Detective could have focused on that case exclusively, but it has other mysteries to solve. Namely, the mysteries of Hart and Cole, both of whom have secrets. And those secrets linger. In a structural choice that makes this series even more fascinating, it takes place in different timelines. One is 1995, when the murder they're investigating occurs. Another is 2012, when the two men are interrogated, separately, by another set of detectives investigating a disturbingly similar murder. This typical scene shows how those two timelines intertwine. It begins in 1995 as Hart and Cole examine the initial crime scene, with Hart asking his new partner to assess the evidence. Cole takes notes and makes drawings in a giant ledger as they talk. Then the scene shifts to 2012, when first Hart, then Cole, give separate accounts of their first impressions of the case.
Okay. Tell me what you see.
Ligature marks on her wrist, ankles, and knees. Multiple shallow stab wounds to the abdomen. Hemorrhaging around throat. Lividity at the shoulders, thighs, and torso. She'd been on her back a while before he moved her.
That's why they called him the tax man. The rest of us had these little notepads or something. He had this big ledger. Looked funny walking door to door with it, like the tax man, which ain't bad as far as nicknames go.
Yeah, of course, I've always taken a lot of notes. I mean, you never know what the thing's gonna be, do you? A little detail somewhere way down the line makes you say, breaks the case.
True Detective is very smartly written and structured and artfully photographed. But it's the performances that dazzle me the most here. Harrelson pulls off a nifty juggling act, being funny one moment and ferocious the next. And McConaughey, who's in the midst of a mid-career resurgence, is flat-out superb as a detective so tightly wound he doesn't sleep, he hallucinates while awake, and is prone to speaking either in long, pessimistic monologues or cryptic monosyllables. When Hart asks Cole the simplest of questions, "Your mom still alive?" Cole answers with one word, "Maybe." And it's the way the two actors respond to one another that makes True Detective TV's latest must-see drama. The Spoils of Babylon, on the other hand, isn't a drama and isn't even must-see, but it's fun. It started Thursday on IFC and is a multi-part production from Will Ferrell's comedy website, Funny or Die, with a very meta concept. It pretends to be a lost period miniseries from a previous era. The era of such overblown romances covering decades as the Thornbirds. It stars Kristen Wiig, Tobey Maguire, Tim Robbins, Jessica Alba, and others, with a theme song sung by Steve Lawrence. It's acted, staged, written, and directed like an intentionally bad Ed Wood movie. And for this pretend lost masterpiece unveiling, it's introduced each episode by its alleged auteur, played by Will Ferrell in all-out Orson Welles gone-to-seed mode. The costumes and tacky direction make me laugh, and so does Ferrell as writer, director, producer Eric John Rosch, whose intros are filmed in an old-school Hollywood restaurant.
The original production of Spoils of Babylon had a running time of 22 hours and was considered, not quite done with that, and was considered too long for network television. Tonight's abbreviated version pales in comparison, and yet, in my humble opinion, is far superior to anything on television today. Mm. The cast is perhaps the finest assembled for the time. There's the young romantic lead, Dirk Schofield, coming off a week-long engagement on the hit television show Telepathy Man. Sir Richard Driftwood, celebrated British stage actor in his first filmed performance, playing an American, no less, with great skill. And my former wife, the beautiful Loria Sandcake, who left us much too soon. And now lives in Arizona with a man who owns a chain of sporting goods stores.
The Spoils of Babylon, for the next few weeks on IFC, has good fun masquerading as TV high art. But True Detective, for the next 2 months on HBO, is the real deal.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Coming up, Emma Thompson discusses acting, English country houses, and her new film, Saving Mr. Banks. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Emma Thompson, stars in the new movie Saving Mr. Banks. She's won 2 Academy Awards, a Best Actress Oscar for the film Howard Zinn, and an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for Sense and Sensibility, which she also starred in. Her other films include Remains of the Day, In the Name of the Father, Primary Colors, Love Actually, Stranger Than Fiction, and three Harry Potter movies. Thompson grew up in London, the daughter of two actors. When she went to Cambridge, she began performing in sketch comedy on stage and television before getting into dramatic roles. In Saving Mr. Banks, Thompson plays P.L. Travers, the author of the Mary Poppins books. The film tells the story of how Walt Disney, played by Tom Hanks, managed to convince the reluctant author to let him make a Mary Poppins movie. We began with a scene from the film. Travers has just arrived at the Disney studios, where she's greeted by composers Richard and Robert Sherman, played by Jason Schwartzman and B.J. Novak, and screenwriter Don DeGrady, played by Bradley Whitford.
Good morning, Pamela.
So discomforting to hear a perfect stranger use my first name. Mrs. Travers, please.
I do apologize, Mrs. Travers. I'm Don DeGrady, the scriptwriter.
Co-scriptwriter? I shall certainly be having my say, Mr. DeGrady.
DeGrady. Wonderful. I welcome your input.
If indeed we ever sign off on a script.
Right. This is the rest of your team. This is Dick and Bob Sherman, music and lyrics, voice, the one and only Mrs. P.L. Travers, the creator of our beloved Mary.
Poppins.
Who else?
Mary Poppins. Never, ever just Mary. It's a pleasure to meet you. Oh, here we shan't be acquainted for very long.
Why is that?
Because these books simply do not lend themselves to chirping and prancing. No, certainly not a musical. Now, where is Mr. Disney? I should so much like to get this started and finished as briskly as is humanly possible. Perhaps someone could point me in his direction. I'd be so grateful. Thank you.
That's our guest, Emma Thompson, as a very tough customer, P.L. Travers, as she arrives at the Disney Studios to consider having them adapt her book, Mary Poppins, to a movie. Emma Thompson, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you. Tell us about getting her voice, getting that character.
Well, I got the script quite early on, and I was very frightened by it because she was such a complicated character. I'd never really played anyone quite so contradictory or difficult before, and so I started to investigate her. And she's written an awful lot of very interesting things, and not only the Mary Poppins books, and she was really a very fascinating woman. There's one very good biography of her by a woman called Valerie Lawson, and there's lots of interviews. But crucially, there are the tapes of the meetings that she had with the Sherman brothers and Don DeGrady. She insisted that all of the time that they spent together was tape recorded. So there are 67 hours of those tapes, and they're just killingly just tortuous to listen to, because she was awful to those young men. She hated the whole idea. She didn't want to give it up, but she, at the same time, having come over overtly to cooperate, but somehow inside her wanting to subvert everything about the process, she just interfered, she patronized, she demeaned their efforts, she was rude about everything and everyone. She didn't eat with them. She would sit on her own in the commissary. She was vile about America and Americans to people's faces. She announced to the boys that Americans just don't know how to learn poetry, or they don't know how to recite anything. So one day they all turned up at her table in the commissary and recited the Gettysburg Address, all standing in front of her. Not even that charmed her. She just made a humph noise and went back to her meal. So she was determined. And in such a state of, what's the word? She was so defended, I suppose. She was so resistant to handing over this person who, I suppose, to her was a great deal more than a fictional character that she had written. In fact, she used to say, I didn't create her. She just flew in through the window one day.
Finding those tapes, those many, many hours of tapes with P.L. Travers speaking with the writers, must have been a treasure for someone trying to develop a character. Did you imitate the voice? How did it help you get the voice?
It was hugely helpful. I can't tell you, because Well, one of the interesting things about listening to those tapes is, you know, hearing the relaxed kind of American thing of the guys going, okay, well, we're going to do this, we're going to start this, very kind of California and all that's going on. And suddenly there's this voice that comes in and there's a tremendous distress in it, because you can hear that the breathing is a little... And she can't get the words out of course, and then no, these sounds come here, just stopping them. No, then we can't do that. No, we cannot do that. And then suddenly she'd go into a dreadfully sort of patronising thing, because that would not be British. It would not be terribly British. In fact, she slightly reminded me of Margaret Thatcher, who I always wanted to punch from the moment that she came into power to the moment she left. But partly because of that voice and the very, very patronising way in which she would talk to people who she clearly felt were idiots.
We're speaking with Emma Thompson. She stars with Tom Hanks in the new film Saving Mr. Banks. You grew up in a family of actors. Your parents were actors. Mm. Your sister's an actor. Did you always think that's what you'd want to do?
No. Au contraire. I didn't want to do it at all. My sister knew from very early on, had showed all her skill and talent quite early on, and left school and went and worked professionally at the age of 16 and was brilliant, and then went to drama school and then carried on and has been and is the most extraordinary actress. Quite brilliant. And so she was always that person who was going to do that and knew from the start, whereas I was very unsure. I liked reading more than anything, and I think at one point there was a hospital administrator came to talk about her work at our school, and I thought that sounded like an interesting job. And I remember she had very nice shoes. Maybe I could get shoes like that if I became a hospital administrator. Then I suppose I went to university. I went to Cambridge and I read English and I joined the Footlights, and that's when I started to figure that I might be able to be a comedian, and I wanted to be a Lily Tomlin, really.
Lily Tomlin, the American comedian, yeah.
The American comedian, yes, whose work with Jane Wagner, notably Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, I greatly, greatly admired. And I loved all the female comedians of that ilk.
I find this fascinating. I read that you had thought of yourself as becoming a comedian. And, you know, I think American audiences especially think of you as, you know, this sophisticated, you know, a self-assured woman from all these period dramas. You were in a BBC series called Thompson, right?
Yes.
Which lasted 6 episodes. I gather did not do well critically, but out of that, Lindsay Duran asked you to adapt the Jane Austen novel Sense and Sensibility to screen.
Yeah, fine.
Did you always picture yourself in the role of Eleanor?
Well, I did when I was writing it, but I didn't take it for granted that I would necessarily play her, because in our world you understand that it's always the director who
right.
gets to choose who's playing. But luckily, when we found Ang Lee, who had just produced this extraordinary film called Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, which had a scene between two sisters that contained exactly the same line as the scene in Sense between the two sisters, which is where one turns to the other and says, "What do you know of my heart?" It's about sisters who know each other, but of course don't really know each other, mm-hmm. don't know what's going on deep, deep down.
I want to ask you about a scene at the end of this film. And this is a film in which one of the things we notice is that the relationships all follow the conventions of the day, and people are very polite, and the conversation is sort of indirect and restrained. And the man, Edward, who you've had great affection for, mutual affection throughout the film, you've come to recognize that you will never have him because the family has learned that he has married another woman he had made a promise to. And then there's a scene where you and your sister and mother are there. He arrives. And it's revealed that, in fact, you were misinformed. His brother had married. Edward is, in fact, unattached and available to you. And your reaction is to begin weeping uncontrollably. And this is so interesting because with the entire film, you've been so proper and so restrained in what you say. To see this raw emotion come pouring forth, it was enormously effective. Doesn't make a particularly good radio clip because we hear Emma Thompson weeping, but... But I wanted to, I don't know if that's the way Jane Austen wrote it. Could you talk about that moment?
I seem to recall that she may have taken herself off outside for a minute to shed a tear, but she certainly didn't do what I'd written. That would probably not have happened. I think they probably would have been able to hold it together terribly well, because that's what they were used to doing, of course, in those days. And I remember Hugh Grant, though, looking at me and saying, are you going to do that? I said, what? I said, you're going to cry like that all the way through my last speech? And I said, yeah. What's the problem? He said, well, it's my last speech. You can't. I said, yeah, but Hugh, it's funny. It's funny, which is the point. It's funny. It's also, of course, it's moving, but it's that, I think, very difficult balance, but vital balance between something having humour, having wit, but also being moving, that I always strain to reach and achieve. You know, it's difficult. Alexander Payne's one of the people, I think, achieves that so often in his movies, that you're laughing and you're also very moved at the same time. Right. That's my favourite thing in a movie, actually.
One of my favourite films of yours is Remains of the Day, the 1993 film directed by James Ivory, based on the novel by Kazuo Ishiguro. It's, of course, the story of this English butler, Stevens, in the 1930s, working at the manor house of Lord Darlington. And you play the housekeeper, Miss Kenton. Mr. Stevens, of course, played by Anthony Hopkins. And you have this important supervisory position. And this is a story of how you become acquainted and develop great affection for each other, which is never really expressed. You know, there are a lot of films about unrequited love. This is sort of unexpressed. The closest he gets to declaring his affection is saying that this house means very much to you. I want to play a scene. And this is a moment when you, as Miss Kenton, enter Mr. Stevens' study, again, played by Anthony Hopkins, and he's reading a book. And she wants to know what he's reading and kind of persists. Let's listen to this.
What are you reading?
A book.
Yes, well, what sort of book?
It's a book, Miss Kenton. Book.
What's the book? Are you shy about your book?
No.
Is it? Is it racy?
Racy?
Are you reading a racy book?
Do you think racy books are to be found on his lordship's shelves?
What do I know? What is it? Let me see it. Let me see your book.
Please leave me alone, Miss Kenton.
Why won't you show me your book?
This is my private time. You're invading it.
Oh, is that so?
Yes.
I'm invading your private time, am I?
Yes.
What's in that book? Come on, let me see. Or are you protecting me? Is that what you're doing? Would I be shocked? Would it ruin my character?
And that's our guest, Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins in Remains of the Day. You know, I listened to your voice in that scene. I think it made me the most erotic scene in film in which no one addresses each other by their first name.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary scene to film, actually. I remember we weren't quite sure how to do it, or at least I wasn't sure how to do it, and I came in a bit too brisk and kind of no-nonsense-y on it. And Tony, who taught me so much, and I worked with him twice on how to...
It's Anthony Hopkins, for those who aren't
Anthony
on a first
Hopkins.
Name basis. Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry. He said, listen, think of it as it's one of those lazy afternoons. There's nothing much to do. There's a fly dying busily in the window ledge, and it's a bit warm, and just take out all of that busyness and all of the briskness that Miss Kenton always has, as she's quietly suppressing all her emotions and all her sexual feelings and everything that that really doesn't do to be shown when you're a housekeeper of a huge house. And that kind of solved it for me, and then it did become immensely erotic. And Tony's very good. He's like a little sort of human volcano, quietly ready to go off, pop at any moment, but held in. And so he's got this extraordinary internal heat and power. And so I remember we shot it maybe, I don't know, 2-3 times. But I remember at the end of it, I hadn't really breathed much, and I got quite faint at the end of each take. And I said, oh, that's interesting. You're just stopping me from breathing.
Wow. One more thing I wanted to ask you. I read that you lived across the street from your mom and in the same neighborhood as your relatives for many years. Is that the case?
Yes, indeed, it is the case. I've lived in the same road all my life. It's quite odd. Mum lives opposite, so if we open her front door and my front door, you can see into each other's kitchens. So that little stretch of road in between is a kind of corridor that we'll often be seen passing wearing dressing gowns and carrying mugs of tea. And I think that's the only way to live. And my sister-in-law lives just down the road, and luckily, Jim Carter, who plays Carson in Downton Abbey, lives 3 doors down, so one can always call upon him for butlery services at any time of the day or night. And my sister used to live just up the road in my uncle's old flat, but now lives 10 minutes away. So it's a very close-knit community.
Right. I mean, it's wonderfully appealing, but given your success, you don't want to have a place with an ocean view or, you know, enormous room and all of that stuff.
No, I appear to have resisted the fantasy film star lifestyle that I feel an awful lot of people assume that I live. It's very odd when I'm on the tube at home or on a bus. You say, what are you doing here? I said, I use the underground. It's London. I've always lived here. So there is, I think, a strange assumption.
And I'm told your 2 Oscar statuettes occupy the downstairs bathroom?
Yes, they do. They've made various journeys. They've been in my office. But they seemed, I don't know, unhappy there. I think they prefer to be, you know, at the seat of all guests, to be available, to be picked up and handled. And in the privacy of that small room, which also contains a lot of my daughter's art. So it's rather a special place.
Well, Emma Thompson, it's been fun. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much, Dave. I've loved it.
Emma Thompson plays P.L. Travers, the author of the Mary Poppins books, in the new film Saving Mr. Banks. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.